Hey, you found us. Welcome. We are really glad you're here. Maybe you're here because you heard the 4-minute trailer we put out recently. Maybe you're intrigued, but still want a little bit more before you officially commit to another podcast. So for you, my discerning listeners, the first episode is a bigger window into what we're going to be doing on the show. The experts we'll be talking to, the questions we'll be taking on, and the solutions we'll be discussing. Well, I was recently interviewing a student from the class of 2024 who graduated with a job. And I asked them how they felt about starting a new job. The answer sort of shook me. They said, "I'm just wondering how screwed am I? Not excited, not hopeful, but really wondering how am I going to salvage this gig, a subpar role at an unknown company." It made me realize we are making this podcast for everyone who wonders, how screwed am I and what can I actually do about it? Do you feel like you wondered that alone? You're not alone. Most students are either concerned or alarmed about the kind of offers they've gotten this year, which is consistent with our findings. The Chem conducted an official survey, and 70% of students said that they've had to take up compromised jobs this year. This feeling of powerlessness in the face of the magnitude of the problem is the reason we wanted to start this podcast in the first place. Because if we can take this feeling, which is very collective this year, and see if we can realistically do something about it. Wait, I should probably introduce myself. I'm Aksha Chandrasekharan, a journalist with The Ken, and I cover careers and workplaces for a living. And this is the first episode of our brand new early careers podcast called The First 2 Years. If you're listening to this on your commute to work, thinking about how do I make work work for me, then this episode is for you. On today's episode, we'll talk about how to turn a job that you have into a job that you want, when quitting is not an option for you in the near future. Ooh, theme music.
So the pressure to get a good job starts from the day you enter the college. Before I got my admission letter, I got a mail from SBI saying that we will approve your entire loan right away, right? So you have this fear that I need to pay 30 lakhs. And now there is SBI saying that no co-borrower needed, no collateral needed. We'll give you complete 30 lakh rupee loan right away.
That's Ronak Burana. He recently graduated from XLRI Jamshedpur. He found out that he got into his college from this email from State Bank of India approving his loan before he even heard from his B school.
And once you take that money, once you sign the document and you enter the college, now you get this fear that I need to pay this 30 lakh rupee loan back and you need a job. Here there was this one ambition to get the best firms on the campus. For some it could be product management firms, some consulting firms, some IB firms, but people wanted the best. So when you enter that race with a 30 lakh rupee loan on your head, you really want to get the best job.
Spoiler alert, this story sort of ends well because Ronak did find a job with American Express that'll allow him to pay his education loan of 30 lakh rupees.
So I remember, I was taking an afternoon nap and I got a call from somebody in the placement committee and they told me that, so when I got the call, I knew that it would either mean that the placement committee friend would say that, hey, we did not get an offer for you, or we have got an offer for you. So I was in that whole zone. So when I got the call, I picked it up and I knew that it was one of my friends in the placement committee. And they said that you're done, you're checked out, you're over. And that gave me the sense of relief. And right away, I called my manager thanking him that I am done. Thank you so much. That I just wanted to somehow check out because I knew that the market was really bad.
When you saw the offer, did the loan cross your mind? Were you like, I am good, like the 30 lakhs that I took, I'll be able to pay it back? How did that feel?
I have a small Excel sheet made in my mind, which has 40 lakh rupees EMI for the loan, a living cost, my savings, taxes, etc. And I know that if I get an offer, I can put in the numbers that I know from my company. If I don't get an offer, those numbers will always be zero or awaiting until I get an offer.
So Ronak meant 40,000 rupees and not 40 lakh rupees in EMI.
the moment I knew that I got the offer, the Excel sheet was completely filled. And there were these small fireworks happening around the Excel sheet, knowing that I can close this Excel sheet for at least the next six, seven months now.
Okay, so think about placements through the lens of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. At the very bottom, you have your food, safety, shelter, basically physiological needs. In the placement universe, the bottom of the pyramid would be finding a job that pays you well enough to cover your EMIs on your education loan. You have to satisfy this need before you move on to anything else. This was something that people used to take for granted in the previous years, a job that pays you well. But Ronak knows that that's not the case this year. He's lucky compared to many of his friends and batchmates who are stuck between low-paying jobs and massive education loans.
And you can see a very stark difference between what my batchmates are feeling and what my seniors did. So I know many in my seniors who got placed in the final, in their final placements when the market was really good. And they were sad because they did not get the companies they wanted. The sadness that they experience is very different from what my batchmates are experiencing because they're dealing with a lot of uncertainty. A lot of people are placed in companies that have never come on campus before. So you don't have any alums, etc. you can reach out to, any seniors you can reach out to. You have no idea what to do. The best you can do is look at our Glassdoor reviews, which again are very mixed, right? Because you don't know what to expect. Do you trust a review that was written 2 years ago? And for the next 3 months before you start joining, you just keep thinking about that review that, is this what my life is going to be? And there's this Excel sheet I told you about, right? About the CTC. And you know ki usme se 40,000 is going to go for the EMI. What are the other components? How will the breakdown happen, etc.? And how much will I end up earning or how much will I end up saving, etc.? So that fear always stays with everyone.
Though Ronak is better placed than his peers, he's still able to recognize the lack of flexibility that comes with most entry-level positions.
So most of us, we join as management trainees and I have no idea where I'll be put. And there's nobody from the staffing team who will call me and ask that, hey, we have XYZ roles, where do you want to join? You just randomly assign to one specific department. And that is something that can be improved upon in the sense that I would really appreciate if somebody calls me and asks that, we have XYZ places for you, which one would you want to join? Because that would further align with where I want to, as compared to, you know, just randomly taking people and putting them wherever you want.
Ronak is right. The campus placement is not designed for choice. It's often that companies choose you over you choosing the company. You are assigned a role, the responsibilities are predetermined, even the location, mode of working, everything is decided for you. So it can often feel like a lottery. You never know what you will get. And the way the system is, it's unlikely for anything to change. This is also why a large number of students move on from their first jobs really quickly. This year, it has only exacerbated.
A lot of people are looking out, like the statistic is shocking, but I can also see it play out. I was recently recruiting for positions and there were a lot of applicants who've changed jobs in 2023 who are looking out again. And that always comes across as like a concerning signal. And we also got more applications than we anticipated for this position, which again was concerning because as much as it's nice to have choice, I'm also like, there shouldn't be these many people applying to one role. Like the odds of clearing a job should not be like writing the UPSC exam. So that again struck me as, you know, maybe there's a little bit of panic. There's a little bit of unhappiness in terms of where somebody's at right now.
Yeah, I would say a lot bit, you know, not a little bit. Like
yeah.
A...
yeah.
Balaji Ramachandran has been on both sides of the table. He graduated from IIM Ahmedabad in 2017 and joined the consulting company Bain right out of his college. A dream opportunity that many would kill for in the MBA universe. But to everyone's surprise, and quite uncharacteristically even for him, he quit his consulting career after a couple of years. Because until then, he was pretty convinced that he must take a conventional career path. He then made a hard pivot to startups. After a four-year stint at An Academy, right now he's the director of growth at Meesho. So I also understand that not every gig can be salvaged. Some roles are so awful that there is no hope for making them tolerable, let alone fun. But if your boss isn't abusive and your benefits are good, and like Ronak and many others in the same boat, you're just worried about joining a team that you don't like or getting projects that aren't challenging enough, and your primary complaint is boredom or lack of autonomy, I can help. Coming up next is how do you inch your responsibilities towards things you enjoy and change how you think about work.
When this happens, I think firstly it's a good sign, because if you are essentially in a role where you're indifferent about if it's happy or sad, then essentially you're not really concerned about the future. You're quite fine with the present being the same for the rest 10, 20 years. So when you're in that uneasy place, I think then the answer is, okay, if I don't like what I'm doing, what am I looking for? Like, what is most important to me? And I do believe you can optimize for multiple things. You can optimize for the industry you're in. You can optimize for function. You can optimize for people. You can optimize for salary. You can optimize for work-life balance. And it's not a either or. It isn't a higher salary is equal to lower work-life balance. It is just whatever I choose, whatever I want to do instead, I need to think a little bit more about it. So that's an exploratory journey as to what do I really care about? What are trade-offs I'm willing to make?
Yeah, I think I would break it down even further, right? Like the things that you discussed, I think number one thing that you said was the dissatisfaction is good. It's a sign that you might be ambitious, you want to do more. You might be affected with this disease called ambition. And these are your symptoms that you want to do more and you want more. And so lean into that discomfort and maybe don't shy away from it. And that would take you to the next step of investigating what your aspirations and anxieties are.
And I think that's like this state of unhappiness is when you will start to have those conversations, reach out to people. These could either be trusted folks in your own company, or it could be your friends or batchmates, typically to understand why they like what they do, as opposed to, hey, I'm really enjoying my work. But if you can double click into that as to why do you enjoy it? Is it the challenge of the work? Is it the fact that it is very fresh every day? Is it the fact that the people you're working with make it interesting? And then you'll realize that some of those things, even if it sounded great on paper, you may not enjoy 1 year, 2 years down the line.
Okay, say this person has gotten a good grasp of what they like, what they enjoy doing by talking to a lot of people and introspecting. Of course, nobody fully ever knows what they like doing, right? They have a hunch and they're following their curiosity. I'm using a milder word than passion because they're just following their curiosity. But also one of the things that I've noticed a lot is that many of these early career roles, entry-level roles and management trainee roles isn't infused with a lot of flexibility. You might see avenues, you might see opportunities, but you have to convince a whole lot of people to actually be able to get them, right? Because your responsibilities are fully laid out, like A, B, C, and so on. But you're interested in this completely different thing that a different team is doing, and you actually think you might be good at it. But you don't have the proof of concept to convince anyone because you're literally just starting out. So then it makes me wonder, how do you convince a stubborn boss in a very rigid organization? The worst case scenario, actually. And has that ever happened to you?
Absolutely. I think it would have definitely happened to everybody at some point. Unless you had a perfect career, you would definitely have had an instance where you would have an instance where you want to do something else and you're not yet sure how to get there. So I think one, it's very natural. It's in fact a good thing again, because it'll give you like a little bit more thinking room. You'll start to explore a little bit more. You'll be more curious, like you mentioned. So I think it's not a science in terms of switching functions or switching roles. I think it's more of an art. Though I can give you an example from an academy. My role predominantly was, I started off doing strategy and ops. So it was cross-functional initiatives. When I moved to a new team, the role I was given was more, can you fix the customer service process? I'm getting a lot of angry pings. But it's not answering them that I'm concerned about. All of those pings are real problems. Can you take the crux of that problem and solve it? So don't focus on pacifying the customer. Solve the problems that are 1% of customers who are extremely unhappy. They are telling us. Listen to them and tell me what are the biggest problems, and then work with whoever you need to fix that. Incredible learning. I think for the first one and a half months, it was incredible. But then towards the third or fourth month, it started becoming fairly repetitive. We'd solve the most important, the most needle-moving problems, and then there were obviously a lot to still solve, but then it became very chill. So then my boss also started realizing that, and he's like, yeah, I know your feet are a little itchy right now because you're doing similar things, but don't worry, hang in there, I'll give you something. While he knows that, it's not like he's going to go out of his way to say, you have to do this. But let's say the next meeting, when I heard that something's coming up, we're planning this idea, I went up to him and said, hey, can I do this? I have context about this. I want to give it a shot. It's a pilot, so it's low risk for the company. Can I take it up? And I had the time to do so. So I will continue my responsibility, but I can start doing so. And within 3 months, I'll train someone else to do my current project, or I'll hand over. So I know that he had an inclination to give me other work, and then it became my responsibility to seize the opportunity. So that way I got to move away from that core ops function to something that is a lot more fun for me, which was doing a lot of customer research, figuring out how to open a new store. So that became like very, very exciting work, but it wouldn't have come on its own.
The part that stands out to me the most is that you seem to have conviction that you can do something that you've never done before, right? I wonder where that's stemming from. And I'll tell you the reason why I'm asking. Because I often joke with my friends and work colleagues that I have imposter syndrome about having imposter syndrome. It's like, am I good enough to even have imposter syndrome, right? Like meta imposter syndrome. And many of the early career folks that are starting out, I believe, may also not have that body of work like me to remind them of how good they are. Which is why I'm interested in knowing where is this confidence stemming from and how do I do it, asking for a friend.
I think it just comes from like blind faith. I don't think I had like a PhD in it or anything. I think the way I look at it is in a startup, like the skills you want to have, you won't necessarily have. Or let's say the most important business priority that needs to be solved, you may not have the skills to solve it today, but you can't wait until you're prepared. Sometimes you just have to go take a stab at it. And while you're taking a stab at it, you learn like in an accelerated exponential fashion, and you'll figure things out. You'll speak to people to solve the problem. So I was betting more that I'm excited to solve this, therefore I'll find a way, as opposed to I already know. So when I told him I had context, what I meant was I understand the problem. I don't know how to solve it. I have zero clue how to solve it.
Interesting. Radical concept for me, honestly, that you can do something even before you're good at it. It reminds me of this quote that perfectly summed it up, that perfection is just fear in high heels. You know, like trying to make something perfect, having to be good at everything you do, is sort of a paralysis or a fear that at least I'm still trying to shed, honestly. Anywho, thank you, Balaji, for embellishing your stories with examples and personal experiences. I learned a lot. Okay, so here's what I'm taking away from this conversation. Number one, if you're dissatisfied with your entry-level role at your first ever job, it's a good thing. It's a very common thing and it's a good thing. It's an opportunity for you to introspect and find out what your priorities are, what are the trade-offs you're willing to make in your career, and what truly matters to you. Number two, you don't have to do it all by yourself. Reach out to people within your office and outside of your workplace. But inside the organization, you can take your colleagues for a coffee or say yes to organizing office parties or offsites or something like that to establish a rapport with your colleagues. Because trust and familiarity, as I've learned, is built in small moments. So you don't have to wait for that big cross-functional project to come your way to connect with people. Number three, if you're trying your hands at something for the first time, you don't need proof of concept, but you need proof of conviction. If you can say yes to things even before you know how to do them, you're definitely setting yourself up for success. Your work just instantly becomes more enjoyable and challenging, and it's just overall better. By the way, I've also learned that your manager doesn't dictate the scope of your work and roles and responsibilities. You do. You have to remember that you have agency in this whole process. Thank you so much for listening. Tell me what I missed. Tell me what you like. You can write to me at aksha@the-ken.com with feedback and more topics you'd like us to cover. All the information you need is in the show notes below. The First 2 years was written and hosted by me, Akshay Chandrasekharan, produced by Anushka Mukherjee, with sound engineering by Rajiv CN. This is our show launch, so I have some more shout-outs to folks who helped us get this far. Thanks to product and engineering team Moon and Iqbal. Thanks to my colleague Snigdha Sharma. Our theme song was composed by Kalmi and our show art was done by Sneha Dasgupta. Thanks for listening. See you next Tuesday with a brand new episode. Follow us so you don't miss an episode when it drops.